Good morning, and thank you for joining us today. We hope you had a good break. Given the timing of the results announcement shortly before Christmas, the view was that there was a limited benefit to hosting a call on the day. However, we did want to provide an opportunity to answer any questions you may have on the interim financial statements for the 6 months ended 30th of September 2023. As the announcement set out, the board is continuing its work on the strategic review, and as such, it would be inappropriate for the investment advisor to take questions or speculate on its outcome. If you have any questions or comments regarding the board's strategic review, please speak to the company's broker, Singer Capital Markets. Dan Pounder, CFO of Hipgnosis Song Management, will now take you through the key points of the results before opening up to questions.
Thank you, Rufina. It is now 4 months since I took up the position of CFO at Hipgnosis Song Management, and this is the first time I've briefed you as a results statement. Over the last few months, I've spoken to many of you on the call as I've been introduced to the company's investors and analysts. Like other new members of the Hipgnosis Song Management team, I have extensive music publishing experience, in my case, about 20 years. My conversations with investors confirm my initial thinking that there were things we could do to make our reporting more transparent and straightforward, and much work has been done on this front. Specifically, for the first time, we have included detailed catalogue by catalogue data for the company's top 55 catalogues, representing about 80% of the company's PFAR. A standalone P&L for Hipgnosis Songs Group LLC, and PFAR data that is now aligned to the financial year rather than the calendar year. We've also provided much greater information about the company's catalog bonus provisions and contingent liabilities, with more detail on the calculation metrics, potential catalog bonus values, and importantly, the catalog growth required to trigger them. Working with the board, I will continue to review the company's disclosures and consider whether any further steps are needed to provide additional transparency for users to better understand the company's accounts. Since I joined, I've conducted a balance sheet review, which is now complete, except for work to enhance the company's revenue accrual methodology. The time since I've joined has been, to say the least, eventful. As a result of a reassessment by the portfolio independent valuer of the amount of CRB3, the board revoked the dividend due to be paid in October to ensure that the company remained compliant with its debt covenants. Subsequently, the balance sheet review led to additional provisions for capital users, which are now viewed as likely to be paid given the latest information on catalog performance. Reassessing critical judgments and estimates as new information becomes available is a key part of the proper functioning of the control environment and something which I am completely committed to delivering to the board, even when it results in difficult outcomes. I am aware you've all read the results statement, so I'll aim to keep my opening remarks on the financial performance brief before I take questions. First, to net asset value. For the reasons set out in the financial review of the results announcement, I will focus my remarks on the operative NAV. In the period to 30th of September 2023, the operative NAV per share decreased by 9.2% to $1.7392 at 30th of September 2023. This was primarily due to a 6.4% decrease in the fair value of the portfolio to $2.62 billion, driven by a reassessment of anticipated receipts relating to CRB3 retroactive payments and CRB4 future cash flows. Additionally, the portfolio independent valuer has reduced its expectation of future cash flows from alternative platform licensing, such as TikTok and Peloton, and there is a $47.5 million reduction, representing a reassessment of the impact of the US 35-year reversion rule by the independent valuer. This is almost exclusively related to catalogs which were purchased as part of Cobalt Fund 1, where the company did not purchase catalogs directly from songwriters. The portfolio independent valuer has maintained its 8.5% discount rate. Turning to revenue. Total revenue from continuing operations decreased to $63.2 million from $86.4 million in the same period last year. Net revenue from continuing operations decreased $54 million from $76.8 million. In the equivalent period last year, a CRB3 accrual of $19.2 million was recognized, representing the expected retroactive payment owed to the company following the rejection of the attempt by certain streaming companies to appeal the original CRB3 settlement. As a result of a reassessment of these CRB3 retroactive payments, $11.9 million of the accrual has been derecognized in this reporting period. These accrual movements make it difficult to see the underlying performance of the portfolio. However, it's important to note that excluding these one-off accruals, we see underlying net revenue increasing from $57.6 million to $65.8 million, growth of $8.2 million, or 14% on the same period last year. I'll now move on to pro forma annual revenue, or PFAR. This provides an understanding of the like-for-like performance of the company's revenue. The six-month PFAR for the period increased 10%, to $64.9 million. Streaming and performance revenues performed strongly, with increases of 14.7% and 10.9% period on period, respectively. The increase in streaming revenues can be attributed to the ongoing growth in the popularity of streaming services, increases in subscription rates which streaming services charge, and the implementation of CRB4. Whilst performance revenues finally appear to have fully recovered following the impact of COVID lockdowns. There was a 2% decline in synchronization income, which reflects some of the natural variability we see from this income stream. Moving down the statement of profit and loss, adjusted operating costs, less interest expense, a measure of the company's underlying operational expenditure excluding non-cash and financing items, decreased by 1.9% to $14.3 million. This is primarily due to a 20.1% reduction in the advisory fee to $5.4 million, which is a function of the company's market capitalization during the period on which the fee is calculated. Overall operating expenses from continuing operations increased by 25.4% to $117.7 million for the six-month period. This increase is driven by the recognition of a further catalog bonus provision of $26.5 million, a topic I will return to shortly, and impairment of the catalog of songs of $15.2 million. This is offset by $19.7 million dollar fair value gain recognized on the company's held for trading derivative financial instruments. Whilst a large proportion of the company's costs are not directly controllable, I believe that there is scope to reduce discretionary spending. Therefore, working with the board, my colleagues and I are currently undertaking a review to ensure that all discretionary spending provides appropriate value to the company shareholders. Those costs which we do not believe deliver value will be eliminated. I will be able to provide more details on this at the full year, when you will also start to see the impact of the measures that are already in place. As I mentioned earlier in today's announcements, we've provided far more information about the catalog bonuses than we have done in the past. Catalog bonuses are payments to songwriters where additional payments become due if performance hurdles set out in the original purchase agreements are met. During the period, we've recognized an additional $26.5 million in catalog bonus provisions, which relate to six further catalogs, where based on the information we now have available, we now judge it likely that the bonuses will be triggered. This increase is partly offset by the release of a provision of $3.4 million, where two catalogs ultimately did not achieve the performance targets necessary to trigger payments. This illustrates that the judgment required on catalog bonus provisioning is not necessarily one way. In addition to the recognized catalog bonus provisions, there are a further 19 catalogs that have active catalog bonus clauses. In these cases, based on current and expected performance, we judge it unlikely that they will meet their performance hurdles. Collectively, these 19 catalogs have a theoretical bonus liability of $75 million and are considered contingent liabilities. In conclusion, whilst there is strong underlying performance from the portfolio's assets, this has been overshadowed by the material balance sheet adjustments. Nevertheless, the 14% increase in underlying IFRS net revenue and 10% increase in PFAR once again demonstrates the enduring quality of the underlying assets. And with future tailwinds from both streaming growth and subscription price increases, I expect revenues will continue to grow strongly, and our focus is on ensuring that this increasingly converts into value for shareholders. With that, I'm very happy to take questions about these results.
Thank you. Of course, if you'd like to ask a question by the telephone lines, you can do so by pressing star followed by one on your telephone keypad. If you choose to withdraw your question, please press star followed by two. When preparing to ask your question, please ensure your phone is unmuted locally. As a reminder, that's star followed by one on your telephone keypad now. Our first question comes from Christopher Brown of JP Morgan. Christopher, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Rapina. Thanks for the overview there. I wanted to sort of just get a bit behind the sort of the PFAR numbers. In particular, I was sort of, you know, looking at the PFAR numbers, I think they're before, before any payaways, and obviously with the Cobalt portfolio, you know, there's quite a lot that needs to be paid away. So I just wonder if these help me in terms of thinking about, how we adjust that PFAR number for what sort of gets paid away, and particularly in respect to the network catalogue, because, you know, I think it's the second highest generator of PFAR, but obviously, most of that's going to be paid out. So if you could give some guidance on that, perhaps. And also, now you've disclosed where you've got publisher and writer shares, whether you could talk a little bit about where those publisher shares will revert to the writers. That's presumably mainly in the Cobalt portfolio, and presumably where you've bought writer share and publisher share, that actually reverts Hypnosis. But I just wonder whether you could sort of just expand on those, please.
Thank you, Chris. In terms of the PFAR disclosure, we haven't undertaken an analysis to look at by catalog and by income type the values that would be paid away. So we've always created this analysis because it's based on statement values on those gross revenues. I think this would be something that we could additionally look to develop as we continue to improve the transparency of the results. And it's something that I'll take away from this call as something that we can come back to you on. In terms of the published share reverting, I think you've identified the sort of two aspects to that. We've talked in the results about rights that were acquired through the Cobalt Fund 1 acquisition, where through contractual terms or otherwise, the rights revert away from us. But what we don't talk about, which you kind of touched upon there, is that there are also rights that revert to us. and that provides a future opportunity. It's something that we as a team monitor closely, and we have a schedule of the timing of when those reversions take place. And it's very much the case that every year we'd expect to see a number of catalogs that would be reverting, and that provides an opportunity for us to evaluate the best way to administer those catalogs, whether we seek opportunities with the existing publishers to renegotiate the deals, or we bring those to HSG and our other publishing partners to exploit those directly. And that's very much undertaken as an analysis on a case-by-case basis. In terms of the fair value, that's actually something that Citrin Cooperman don't consider. They very much look at the steady state situation, and they are not assuming that we pick up additional value that we may be able to secure in the future. So there's potential upside both in terms of our earnings, but also in terms of the catalog value that isn't presently captured.
Okay, thanks, Dan. And just a sort of follow-up question really on the PFAR, I suppose, of the catalogs that have been sold in the second disposal. How might we sort of think about the impact that will have on PFAR? Because I guess there's a kind of, top-line effect, isn't there? I alluded to the fact that network, that headline income is very high, but as I say, clearly a lot of that would be paid out. I think that deal was done at, was it about 12 times NPS? So, that suggests that the actual, net revenue that you're going to lose is actually quite low, but the actual PFAR might be quite high.
Well, we provided disclosure in the accounts on the PFAR that relates to the second disposal, and it was $4.4 million in the period. It was $3.1 million in the prior equivalent period. That disclosure is on page 13 of the results PDF, which is available on the Hypnosis website. So hopefully that provides some guidance to you on the materiality. And we will, of course, be providing at the full year results a full analysis of the catalogs that are disposed.
Okay. So you could then look at the realization proceeds, take the multiple that you said you had sold those for, and that would sort of give you the NPS. And then I suppose effectively you'd have a bridge from the PFAR to the NPS.
Yes, I suppose you could try and calculate an estimate in that way.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Ewan Lovett-Turner of Numis. Ewan, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi there, morning all. I think you did say it, but on the sort of accounting adjustments and you said your sort of balance sheet review is done. So you, sort of in terms of further gremlins or so, you're not expecting any of those to necessarily be coming through in coming sort of weeks, months?
Hello, Ewan. Yes, the balance sheet review is complete. Obviously, there's a number of significant critical judgments and estimates that form some of these material numbers, but I'm comfortable that the work that we've undertaken, and particularly when we look at the catalog bonuses, and you'll see in the contingent liabilities note that we've really wanted to show the basis for those calculations and also give you a sense of the numbers that we're looking at when we're estimating the performance that would be required to trigger those numbers and what we would estimate that those numbers look unachievable. And certainly over the coming months, some of those contingent liabilities actually are being timed out because we're reaching the point at which a calculation will be due and we will start seeing those fall away. I think in terms of sort of other areas of the balance sheet, and other people might have questions, but I'll raise it now. We touched on the impairment reviews. That's obviously an ongoing process. We look every 6 months at the carrying value under IFRS and the fair value and make an assessment as to whether there's impairment. That's done on a catalog by catalogue basis. So we're very much looking at individual catalogues and seeing how they're performing. And again, you can have changes to the performance of an individual catalogue, which may cause a change in our assumption. But I think in terms of the core balance sheet, in terms of the things that we have visibility of, the things that I think over sort of the past years have caused a little bit of uncertainty from investors, I'm very comfortable that we've looked at all of those, we've tested them, we've been critical in our assessments, and I feel confident that we, as you phrased it, gremlins wouldn't be materializing over the coming months.
Okay. Thanks. The on the CRB for the sort of the reduction from the expected future income, can you just sort of give a bit more on why that was such a big, why that was a reasonably big adjustment, and just wondering how yeah, what assumptions changed there?
So effectively, the CRB 3 and CRB 4 adjustments in the fair value calculation both stem from the same origin, which is that the receipts that have been received were assumed to be on a lower headline rate than they actually were being paid. And the reason it wasn't that they were being paid at a higher headline rate, it was that the CRB rulings had a number of different prongs by which the calculation could be made. The headline rate was assumed to be the rate at which people were paying. In fact, there were other calculation metrics, and so payments were actually being made at a higher level. So the proportionate increase from the effective rate that the DSPs were paying to the new rates wasn't as large as anticipated. I think people saw that in a very material way when we had to make the change to our previously recognized CRB3 accruals and the consequent impact that had on the dividend. But in terms of when you look at the valuation on that Citroen Cooperman have undertaken, the CRB4 payments are more material because they're stretching out into the future. So they assume that the CRB4 payments continue at that level. There are likely to be CRB5, CRB6 settlements in the future, but their calculation is based on those CRB4 metrics, and that carries over a multi-year, multi-decade period. And that's why when that's discounted back, that becomes a more material number when you're looking at the impact on the fair value. But there hasn't been any impact in our statement of income because those CRB4 receipts and accruals hadn't been made. So there was only an impact on the CRB3 accruals.
Okay. Can you, give a, I presume you can't give much, but any sort of more detailed background on the legal claim that was announced?
I mean, I'm sure you'll understand that as this is an ongoing legal matter, it's difficult for me to say very much more than has already been said. And what has been said is that Merck, HSM, and the company deny the claims, and we intend to vigorously defend ourselves from them.
Okay. And yeah, other people ask questions in a minute, but in terms of the discount rate and how that compares to market transactions, obviously we know some market transactions from the listed market, but are there any other sort of indication or level of investment activity that's going on and the type of valuation that's yielding?
Sorry, Ewan, I wasn't quite sure I understood what the question was.
Investment market activity, so transactions in the market. Have you got any indications of what level of activity there's been and what prices they've been getting recently?
I think you'll probably understand that most of this, the transactions happen in a private market, and it's not possible to obtain pricing information to understand at what price and associated metrics that catalogs are trading.
Okay.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Charles Murphy of Singer Capital Markets. Charles, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Couple of different questions. In the results, there's reference to sort of contract drafting errors. How far have you progressed in reviewing contracts for other issues?
So I think there was a little bit of confusion as to what exactly occurred here. So I think it's probably worth just sort of walking through what happened. And so the contract in question was entirely in line with the parameters approved by the board and therefore in line with the instruction given to the company's external legal advisor for the contract. However, when we reviewed it, and we were reviewing it in the context of the option payment, my team and I, and others at Hypnosis Song Management, did not believe that the contract or the board instruction reflected what had been intended by Hypnosis or indeed the artists. And as soon as we became aware of the potential issue, I alerted the board and Merck spoke to the artists concerned, and we involved the company's legal advisor. And thankfully, as a result of the great relationship that we at HSM and Merck had with the artist was very happy to sign an amendment that effectively reduced the value of their option to the intended level. I think it was really incredible for me to see rapidly over a weekend how the strong relationship we had with the artist was able to deliver this excellent results for shareholders. And now it's clear that the agreement that's in place reflects the terms that were originally intended by all parties. And so there's no additional liability to Song shareholders. And so I think just to sort of address your question, Charles, this didn't come about as in any particular review of all contracts, but was specifically related to us undertaking work related to the contractual terms in question in this particular agreement. And there are no other agreements that have equivalent terms within them.
Brilliant. Thank you. That's very clear. It's good to know there are no other agreements where there's potential issues. On the revenues growth underlying, you said IFRS was net at 14% and PFAR was coming in at 10%. PFAR is a sort of lagging indicator of revenue as far as I understand it. Have you got any sort of guidance or thoughts as to the sort of the scale of the spread? Is it an acceleration or something else going on that we should be thinking about?
So, I think sort of one of the things that I've talked about in the results is the work that we're looking to do to look at our revenue accruals methodology. And certainly when I spoke to investors and analysts in the past few months, the sort of the question you've asked about the link between PFAR and IFRS revenues came up repeatedly. Broadly, you're absolutely right, and one of the reasons that we aligned the PFAR reporting period to be the same as the financial period is this PFAR relates to the statements that we receive from labels and publishing partners and the performing rights organizations, and that broadly relates to the cash that we're also receiving. There's sometimes timing issues between statement receipt and cash receipt, which could throw it out of a period. So PFAR is very much the statements received. And those statements results from activity under which we've derived entitlement to recognize the revenue that took place sometime in the past. But broadly over time, our IFRS revenues will materialize to cash, they will materialize to statements, and they'll be reflected within PFAR. And certainly when I looked at the growth figures and where we think the growth is going to be, we would expect that broadly over time, the IFRS revenues and the PFAR revenues will grow broadly in the same direction at the same rate. We may have periods where our IFRS revenue is growing more rapidly than our PFAR revenue and vice versa. And that the case in point for this period is we have slightly faster growing IFRS revenues than our PFAR revenues. And I think it's worth just dwelling on why that is. And there's a number of reasons for that. One is under our IFRS revenues, we make an assessment of the statement value that we're expecting to receive. And in the case of the current period, we received more statement value than we'd actually accrued. What that does is it gives us a point at which we recognize that additional pickup, and it also gives an increase in the baseline on which we're assuming future revenues. Additionally, we'd be looking at market trends and seeing what's happening in the marketplace. And one of the key things that's happening in the marketplace is we're seeing faster growth in subscriber consumption. We're seeing higher DSP subscription rates, and we're seeing the benefits of CLB4 revenue that is beginning to flow, but has yet to reach us in statements. So those tailwinds, will be driving IFRS revenue a little bit faster than PFAR revenue. But in future periods, we could certainly expect to see that flip over. And as that good news that we're seeing in the IFRS revenue, we would expect to see that PFAR will then step up as we get the statements and we get the cash, and the IFRS revenues may be a little bit less than PFAR. But broadly over time, those two should be growing strongly, and they should be growing together, not quite in lock sync, but broadly over time together. And I think sort of to your sort of general comment is, what are we seeing? What are the expectations of the portfolio? I think one of the advantages of providing the detail is you can see the benefits of a portfolio, that you have some catalogs that are performing exceptionally well beyond expectations, and there are others that are maybe performing less well. And often there are things that are happening. You can have viral TikTok moments that can drive consumption. You can have incredible syncs that drive consumption. You can have the sync value itself. But over time, because of the enduring quality of the catalogs, it isn't the case that we would expect that a catalog potentially declines and then it stays declining. There's huge opportunities for us to work with the catalog, and it's what many of my colleagues at HSM are doing, to actually drive that revenue, to drive consumption to streaming, to drive projects that are introducing new audiences to some of these incredible songs, and also driving synchronization income as we sort of promote catalogs such as Neil Young that historically hadn't been available to synchronization and has driven really significant increases in sync revenue. So I look at, and it's worth saying that, you know, I was very excited to join Hipgnosis because I wanted to see what could be done when you could be super focused on a particular set of songs and catalogs and artists and incredible songwriters and what we could do to drive that revenue forward. And I think the other thing that I was really focused on is how we then convert that to value for shareholders. And that's really sort of how I sort of look at the future. Hopefully that gives you more color, Charles.
Perfect. Our next question comes from Sachin Sagar of Stifel. Sachin, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, morning, Dan. Just a couple of brief questions. Could you just give a bit of an overview of how PFAR has evolved versus your initial underwriting expectations? I guess the sector overall has had quite a strong 2023, so I just want to get a sense of, given what you thought you would get when you originally bought the catalogs, how have the revenues actually evolved versus that, given it's kind of been bouncing around, probably flat to maybe slightly down over the sort of 3-4 year holding period? And then second question is, I don't think you can borrow any more on your RCF given the mandated 30% limit. Just if you could confirm that your intention is not to necessarily ask for that to be increased, just to give yourself a bit more wiggle room going forward if there are any other gremlins or any other unexpected costs.
Sure. Thank you, Sachin. As you're all aware, I've only been here 4 months, so sort of the work that was done in initial underwriting and assessments around how catalogs would perform isn't something that I'm familiar with, but it is something that I'm interested in. And the team that Ben Kotowski leads, I think you've been aware of the significant data project that's been underway at HSM for some time to give us a huge amount of analysis capability. And it is something that I'm keen for us to do. I think there's a good discipline for us understanding the performance of the songs and how that compares to the original underwriting. And it's certainly something that I want to challenge all of us at HSM, particularly those involved in active management, to really focus on ensuring that we are delivering. But I think I'd sort of touch on the sort of remarks I made to Charles about the portfolio effect. I can be absolutely sure there'll be some catalogs that haven't performed to expectation, and we probably have a lot of catalogs that have performed at expectation. But I'm also sure, and we kind of know this because of what's happened with the catalog bonuses, that there are a significant number of catalogs that have outperformed expectation. And I think, you know, any transaction that I've historically been involved in involves a number of assumptions that you make, and in time you will find out if those assumptions were proven out or not. But I think that sort of the benefit that we have with the capital that's deployed across a wide range of songs, both from artists, from songwriters, different genres, different vintages, I think that sort of portfolio gives me huge confidence that the catalog will perform well long into the future. So hopefully that answers that question. In terms of the RCF borrowing, that's very much sort of a matter for the board. But I just sort of give confidence to people that you know, our working capital models and covenant compliance and where we're presently sitting is that the board are looking at the treasury policy and they're wanting to be very prudent and protective of shareholder interests, and that I'm sure as part of the strategic review they'll provide more updates to the market in terms of their intentions.
Okay, great, thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Tom Sharp of Message. Tom, your line is open. Please proceed.
Good morning. Just two quick questions, really. I think the one surprise on the changes for accruals to me was the 35-year rule reversions. So that was quite a significant number at $47.5 million. That legislation's been in place since the 70s. So can you just talk through why that was such a large number or such a large change in assumptions? And secondly, just coming back to litigation, while I appreciate you can't comment on the outcome, you can comment on the quantum. What is the value of the claim that's been made against the company? Thank you.
So thanks for your questions, Tom. In terms of the 35-year rule reversion, I think you'll appreciate that this is my first go through with Citroen Cooperman. It was Cindy Rampersword, the incoming and new chair of the Audit and Risk Committee's first go-through with Citroen Cooperman. And so we really kicked the tires with them around their methodology, their bases, their assumptions, and asked lots and lots of questions and challenged them about the assumptions that they made. And it was part of those questions and that work that they revisited and had another look. And they asked for some additional information from us, which we provided, and they identified that there was some potential risk. And I think it's key to say this is potential. It isn't certain, but they put in some potential risk around some of the catalog that was predominantly acquired as part of the Cobalt Fund 1 acquisition, that some rights may revert. In terms of the quantum, as I kind of outlined earlier in terms of the CRB4 adjustments, when you're looking at a lot of cash flows over a very large number of years, and discounting those back, you can end up with some quite large numbers for relatively small changes in value in any one particular year. And I think that was the case here. In terms of the litigation, it really isn't anything that I kind of want to add to beyond the remarks that I've already made. So thank you for the question, Tom.
Thank you. Our next question is a follow-up from Charles Murphy of Singer Capital Management. Charles, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Good morning. There's one final question. I was just going to ask about sort of what you might have thought sort of normalised margins would look like sort of going forward, because we've got sort of some sort of decent revenue numbers, and it's just sort of what flows down to the fund level. Where there are a bunch of costs and treatment by management fee, but that said, the net's gross to net. But what if you've got a sense of what you think that should look like on a sort of underlying basis?
Thank you, Charles, for the question. I kind of touched on it a little bit in my opening remarks, is that there's a certain amount of the cost base that we can't control. But the board and I are highly focused on those costs that we can control. And it's something that we're wanting to set ourselves some tough tasks to drive as much value from the top line to the bottom line. And it's something that we are presently working on. So that work's underway. So it isn't something that I'm able to kind of give you a definitive response today. But I expect when we come back with the full year results, and possibly before, what we're able to do is give guidance to the market in terms of what we expect that to be. And certainly, you know, when we look forward to the full year results, these results are the interim results. So, you know, many of these sort of one-off items that we've seen in these results will still be in the full year results. But when we get to sort of that full year results position and we're looking at the following year, we can certainly start to look to give the market a cleaner view of what this business should be delivering, both in terms of top-line revenue growth, conversion of that into EBITDA, conversion of that into cash, and then we'll be in a much better position for everyone to really look at this business and see this investment trust as really being able to deliver on its promise, which is with the incredible set of assets that we have, we can give everyone that pure play exposure to the growth in the value of Songs and the associated income that we expect to be able to deliver.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our final question of today comes from Tom Furlong of CCLA. Tom, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Morning. I just wanted to pick up on a few comments in the chairman's statement. I wonder if you could give some additional colour as to why Hipgnosis Songs Management initially refused to give an opinion on the fair value of the portfolio. And then secondly, when you did give an opinion, could you just give some colour on what the caveats were?
Hello, Tom. Thank you for the question. I think it's kind of important to sort of step back a little bit from this and really sort of understand what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with Song. It's a self-managed trust. The board take all the executive decisions, but they receive advice from us, the IA. And that's unlike a more conventional investment trust, which delegates management functions to an authorized investment fund manager. And we're totally committed at HSM to provide services to the company in line with the investment advisory agreement. But we're not regulated, and we're not the company's alternative investment fund manager. When it came to this valuation, I started working on this valuation in September and had a number of conversations, including with the board and predominantly with the board, because it's the board that appoints the portfolio independent valuer. But I've worked constructively, as has our team, to support the board in the challenge that they provided, and you heard about some of the challenge that we provided in earlier responses. But when you step back and think about it, it is an independent valuer, and I don't think it would be appropriate for there to be a perception that HSM is responsible for or influences that independent valuation. Just by its very nature, it would remove the integrity of that independence. And furthermore, we don't have any contractual, legal, or regulatory obligation to affirm the valuation from the portfolio independent valuer. But we do cooperate with the board and the portfolio independent valuer during the production of the portfolio independent valuer's valuation. We provided the board with our views on, amongst other things, the methodologies, the bases, the assumption used for the valuation report, and had a number of meetings in November, at which point we communicated, both formally and informally, our views. And I very much appreciate the need for timeliness and responded to questions as quickly as I could. And where members of my team were involved, they did similarly. And our view is that the fair value determined by Citrin Cooperman provides an impartial view within the bounds of what HSM might expect a valuation agents would reasonably conclude. And furthermore, we sought to put as much disclosure into the accounts as Citrin Cooperman would permit, so that you, the users of the accounts, can understand the bases for those calculations and understand some of the assumptions that are made by Citrin Cooperman, but also understanding that it would be perfectly reasonable for a different valuer to make different assumptions, such as baseline construction, growth rates, discount rates, all of which would result in a different fair value. Indeed, it's also possible that someone would have a completely different approach, and someone asked a question earlier about prevalent sort of market transactions. Citrin Cooperman explicitly do not consider market transactions. They are looking at an income approach, it's a discounted cash flow model, and they have their methodology, and that's the methodology which they're able to issue their opinion on the value of the portfolio. And so hopefully with all of the information that we've put into the results document, you and others are able to make your judgment on that valuation. Hopefully that provides some context, Tom, and you can better understand some of the comments.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we don't have time for any further questions, but please reach out to Investor Relations, Rafina@hypnosissongs.com. I'll now hand back over to Dan for any final closing remarks.
Thank you. Thank you all for your time this morning, and I look forward to speaking to you all again and some of you that I haven't spoken to in the coming months. And I'm certainly expecting over the intervening period that we'll be building on the underlying revenue and PFAR growth, and that we'll continue to deliver some great numbers and improved results for our shareholders. Thank you very much.